This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. By the time Paul Green died in 1981, his Pulitzer Prize for the play In Abraham's Bosom was 54 years old. His longest-running play, The Lost Colony, had been in continuous production for 44 years in the North Carolina coastal town of Manteo. But Green never took to the life of ease that his earlier successes might have afforded him. Into his eighth decade, he continued to write fiction and essays and voice outrage against social injustice in North Carolina. Paul Green was born 117 years ago today in Harnett County near the town of Lillington. In honor of his birthday, we're taking a look at his literary and political legacy as part of our continuing series, North Carolina Literary Lights. And joining me to talk about that is Lawrence Avery. He is a professor emeritus of English at UNC Chapel Hill and the author of A Paul Green Reader. And Marsha Warren is executive director of the Paul Green Foundation. Lawrence and Marsha, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to have you here.
Glad to be here.
Paul Green won the Pulitzer Prize for drama in 1927. The play was called In Abraham's Bosom. What was it about that play that drew the admiration of the Pulitzer Committee? Lawrence?
Well, part of it was the time, the early, certainly after the First World War, there was an upsurge of interest in black experience in America. It was still a very segregated time, and especially in the South, and to some degree in the North as well. But there were a number of very fine black actors and writers that came along, and there was just a growing interest in the experience of blacks. So that was in the background of In Abraham's Bosom's the excitement it generated. It was a play about a black man in the South, the Deep South, who wanted to educate his fellow blacks. And he ran into all kinds of opposition and eventually was lynched. The play ends with his death, so it wasn't a happy play. But people like Ridgely Torrance, Eugene O'Neill, and a little later Mark Connelly were writing plays about black experience, but none of them knew about black experience firsthand in the way that Paul Green did, since he had grown up in this part of the world. So the play makes it clear that the author really knew what black life was like and that he was sympathetic to it, but that he wasn't going to sugarcoat it or make it sentimental. Here is the situation. And given the times in the second half of the 1920s, there was just a receptivity to that kind of play.
And Paul Green certainly grew up in a remarkable era. I mean, here's a man who grew up in the Reconstruction era South and then served in World War I. Give us an idea of what his early life was like.
Well, his father was a pretty prosperous, in relative terms, a prosperous landowner, farmer, and had tenant farmers on his own land. So, and this was just off the Cape Fear River, just outside Lillington, North Carolina. So Green grew up in a farm life. And as Marsha can, she can speak about this too. Green, as a child, learned about blacks and in one way or another came to accept them as equals and full-fledged human beings in a way that even members of his own family didn't. And so his perception of their experience was generated from an early age. And
well, I'm going to ask Marsha about that. Where did that come from growing up in, again, Reconstruction era, Jim Crow, lynchings? This was ground zero. Wilmington, North Carolina, 1898, ground zero for the terrorist movement that would be known as Jim Crow. He grows up not in Wilmington, of course, but how did he develop these ideas? Where did they come from? Do you any sense of how he?
Well, I think it came from the time he was 3 years old. He met a tenant farmer's little child named Rassy, and they were both 3 years old, and they became best friends. They were bosom buddies. In fact, they took a little knife. They had, of course, I mean, you imagine a three-year-old having a knife, but, you know, times were different. And they had a little Barlow knife, and they, this might not have happened when they were three. It might have happened a couple years later. They cut their fingers so that they could be blood brothers. And Paul Green was so surprised to see that little Rassie's blood was red. And Rassie gave him a hard time about that. He said, "Where's your mind when you're thinking about something like that?" Anyway, they stayed friends. And the sad story about it, I can't read that story without getting really teary. Paul wrote this story called Rassie. And he said he learned more from that little child and was informed the rest of his life by the experience he had with that little child who died at the age of 10 of typhoid because Paul Green's father had not properly screened the porches and the house where that tenant farmer's family had lived. And I can remember in the story, the doctor was pretty unhappy with Paul's father for not really paying attention to that.
That was a formative experience for Paul, and that more than any, he, as Marcia said, he wrote a story about that. And that meant that he had mulled it over, he'd thought about it, and it changed his outlook on the world from then on.
It certainly seemed to have an important impact on him, and the idea that he would then devote his life to helping others put themselves in the place of the other. I know in Abraham's Bosom and much of Green's other work, it was shaped by that experience. In fact, we have a bit of tape of Paul Green talking. This is 1975 with a UN history professor, Jacqueline Hall. She is today director of the Southern Oral History Project at UNC. But he talks about that and what it was he was trying to do with his art.
I tried to tell the story of this town farm business. And I felt that somehow if I wrote about a man who tried his everything he could, he worked himself to death almost, and he couldn't make it. And so that the reader would ache in his heart and say, "Oh, this ought not to be like this." Mm-hmm. And that the ache on the part of the reader, the sense of sympathy, the strong sympathy you would have for a man like this, the boy, the young man that failed, would be strong enough to, make it get out and try to do something.
Mm-hmm. There's Paul Green talking in 1975 in an interview that is part now of the Southern Oral History Project. Lawrence Avery, but what does that say about his writing? I mean, here's somebody who says, point blank, "I'm trying to make you feel a certain way, and I want to make you do something." I mean, how does this distinguish, say, from propaganda?
Well, in the first place, the play itself is not propagandistic in the sense that it's preachy or its basic aim is to work on your feelings and the way works of art work on your feelings. And this particular play, if it arouses the right kinds of feelings in your response, is going to make you sad and as Green said in this clip, if you understand a situation of injustice in society and are the right kind of person, maybe you'll go out and try to do something about it. But he wasn't directly propagandistic in the play.
He was, though, a man on a mission. That was there was mission in his art.
He was a man on a mission. And I'm remembering, Lawrence, is this not true that Paul based that story on the experience he had when he was 10 years old, standing along the side of a railroad track, and there were a lot of men who had come back from the Civil War, and there was a black teacher on that train.
Yeah, taking his school class
Durham. And they had some trouble with the engine, and this gentleman got out and had a white shirt on, and he came out, and here was this white engineer down underneath trying to fix what was going on, and this black teacher went up to him and said, "Captain, wonder when we're going to get going, when we're going to get on to Durham." And he said it in a nice way, but of course this white gentleman underneath the train, looking up at this black man with this white shirt on, it was all he could stand, and he got up and he struck him and made the teacher bleed from his head. And I think that Paul had based that idea for in Abraham's bosom for the black teacher, that idea.
Lord, you done ruined my white shirt because he cut his head and he bled on it.
He was also heavily influenced by the beauty, the rural landscape in North Carolina. Play an important part in his work, Lawrence?
It did. And in his life, too, when he would get depressed or have some problem that he had to think about, his tendency was to go take a walk in the woods. And he, in fact, continually moved his own residence. When the city grew up around him, he moved out of town, first to Greenwood in Chapel Hill, and then once that became settled, then further out into the country where his last home was. And in his plays, there is a consciousness of the physical universe in everything he wrote. It's just all the way through there. But it was a spiritually uplifting, nature was a spiritually uplifting thing for him.
Well, we'll talk about what happened when he really moved out of North Carolina to New York and then on to Hollywood and back on the state of things as we examine the legacy of Paul Green as part of our occasional North Carolina Literary Light series. My guests are Lawrence Avery, Professor Emeritus of English at UNC Chapel Hill. Marcia Warren is Executive Director of the Paul Green Foundation. Just ahead, Paul Green and New York's famous group theater on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking about the literary legacy of Paul Green, the North Carolina-born playwright who influenced culture and politics in this state for most of the 20th century and certainly beyond. With me are Lawrence Avery, UNC Chapel Hill Professor Emeritus of English. He's also the author of A Paul Green Reader. Marcia Warren is with us, Executive Director of the Paul Green Foundation. Lawrence Avery is a playwright. Paul Green met with early success outside of North Carolina, and one of his most influential plays, The House of Connolly. The Group Theater chose this for its inaugural performance. Tell us something about the Group Theater.
All right. They grew out of the major producing organization in the 1920s called the Theater Guild, and a group of the younger people in the Theater Guild, all of them highly social conscience, had a high social conscience, wanted to do something to help make the world a better place. And with the blessings of the older heads in the Theater Guild, this younger group pulled out of the Theater Guild and formed the Group Theater, since they were a group of young radicals, social radicals. And Green had sent the House of Connolly to the Theater Guild in 1928, and they had scheduled it for a production, but for one reason and another hadn't gotten around to it. And so when the Group Theater pulled out of the Theater Guild, the leaders of the Theater Guild said, "Here is just your kind of play. Here is a play with a social message. You all take this and do it. We've already worked it out with Paul Green, the author, but this is your kind of play, so you run with it." So that was the first play they did. They all got excited about it. And as Green went to New York and worked, he would stay a week in New York and then go home and then come back for another week of work during the summer of 1931. And
in fact, he never really lived in New York. I mean, he never really pulled up roots.
Family stayed in Chapel Hill.
Well, I'd like to hear a little bit of that play right now. So what I will do is welcome to the conversation Serena Ebhart, an actor and producer with the Chatham County-based EBZB, and her fellow actor Stephen Roten, and they will perform a scene for us from The House of Connolly. And Serena, maybe you can set this up for us.
Sure. In The House of Connolly, it's sort of a metaphor for the Old South, the Transitional South, and the New South. The role of Will that Stephen will be reading today is the transitional South, coming out of the Civil War, trying to figure out how to reconfigure. And they have this old plantation that's fallen down, the House of Connolly, and they're steeped in Southern tradition. And they've got some new tenant farmers who want to make things really work. And so Patsy represents the New South trying to pull us forward, and Will represents the transitional South struggling between keeping up the old traditions and surviving.
Pathetic. Helpless like children. All the Negroes on this plantation are.
Yes. Who are they?
Big Sis and Big Sue.
Yes.
Connolly Negroes. They were slaves of my father's. Everybody knows Big Sis and Big Sue.
Are they crazy?
Gracious, no. Why you ask that?
They look at you funny, don't they? I mean, at me. Funny.
Pshaw. They tell fortunes and that sort of stuff, but they don't mean any harm.
No.
Of course not.
Kill anything?
Shot at some doves far off, just to scare them. I wouldn't like to kill a dove, you know.
Yes. But they're hard to hit, too, aren't they?
They fly like the wind. I killed one once.
You did?
Never wanted to since.
They are pretty things.
It stared out of its eyes, so... Aren't you cold?
Look, there's a line of doves coming this way. Shoot them, quick!
I won't shoot them now. They're going to roost down in the pasture. How do you find the house?
Oh, all right.
You're not too crowded?
We can get along.
How do your fathers and your brothers like it?
All right, I guess.
It ought to have been repaired before you came.
Father and I have fixed it up a lot.
Yes, I know. The yard looks nicer. The house, too. I saw it yesterday, and things all look nicer.
Look, there's another line of them. She suddenly pulls the gun out of his arm, aims at the flying doves, and fires twice in quick succession.
Gracious.
What do you think of that?
There, they're falling down. There, on the edge of the field. Two of them. Gracious.
They fly fast and are hard to kill. Their feathers are so thick.
You're a good shot.
Used to, I'd win turkeys at the shooting matches. 80 yards. I'll run and get them.
No, let them be.
Serena Ebhart and Stephen Roden performing a scene from House of Connolly by Paul Green. We are celebrating his life today on his 117th birthday. Serena Ebhart, how does this play speak to you? I know this is you're very familiar with Paul Green's work. It's had an important impact on you. Tell us about this play.
This is sort of Paul Green's cherry orchard, if you will, very much like Anton Chekhov about old ways versus new ways, trying to struggle through that. I think it's a universal theme. We're doing that right now in our time and place, trying to move from old ideas to new ideas for the greater good. What is interesting about this play is that originally Paul Green had an ending where Big Sis and Big Sue, who were the two old slave women on the Connolly property, actually, at the end of the play, ended up smothering Patsy Tate. And, of course, Patsy Tate represents the New South, the darn Yankees coming down to try to change things and make the nation whole again. And the group theater was this very hopeful, social conscientious group of actors who wanted things to change for the good. And they sat and they talked to Paul Green. They said, it's the middle of the Depression. We've got to have hope. We've got to offer hope to our audiences. And we need you to rewrite the ending. Well, you don't tell a playwright to rewrite their ending. How could you do that? But they argued so effectively. And he changed the ending. And he gave it a little more hope. He doesn't completely say that it's going to work, but he at least gives it a chance. And we'll hear the ending later, if you like.
We will. I want to do that, but I want to ask Lawrence Avery how he felt about that and then how that affected his relationship with the group.
With the group. He enjoyed working with the group. In fact, the story of the play's ending is a little more convoluted than most people know, because when Green wrote the play in 1926, it had the hopeful kind of ending that the group theater persuaded him to go back to, in effect. He wrote the play at the McDowell Colony in New Hampshire, and so he had to write to his wife to tell her what he was doing. And he, in one of his letters, outlines the end of the House of Connolly, and it has the kind of socially hopeful ending that we're going to hear in just a few minutes. So it started off hopeful, then it went to this bleak, hopeless kind of ending. And then the group persuaded Green to change it back. And then later in life, he went back to this tragic ending again with not much hope. I think it fluctuated with his own mood about prospects in the South. And when things looked bleak, he felt like the bleak ending was the appropriate one. But it wasn't a major kind of change for him, since he'd started off thinking about this play with the hopeful ending anyhow.
Well, can we hear it? Let's hear this next scene.
I've run them from their own home. They've got to come back.
No, you haven't done it.
We've both done it then.
They know their own minds, Will. Please listen.
They must have hated me. My God, the cruelty of it.
It is cruel, Will. All this suffering and...
And I thought we were done with the death and suffering.
But we'll stand it. Stand it together. Whatever pain and suffering there is, that's the way it has to be, Will. To grow and live and be something in this world, you've got to be cruel. You've got to push other things aside. The dead and the proud have to give way to us. To us, the living. We have our life to live, and we'll fight for it to the end. Nothing shall take that away from us. Right now, we have to decide it. Will, it's our life or theirs. It can't be both. They knew it, and that's why they went away.
Yes. Yes. Help me. Oh, I need you so, Patsy.
And I'll always be here to help you when you need me.
Aye, you will. You will. Yes, let them go. Let the past die. It's our life now. Our house. He stands, staring out before him as if defiant of the portraits on the wall. The two Negro women who have been looking on, bow their heads over their breast in a sort of hopeless resignation.
Go on back to the kitchen.
Miss Patsy's my wife now. Then you do what she tells you. And with you, I'll go on. I'll go on.
Think of it. Oh, Will, you've had no supper.
Serena Ebhart and Stephen Roden performing the final scene, I think, from the House of Connolly by Paul Green. Marcia, tell us a little bit about his relationship with the group, because they didn't see eye to eye politically.
I'm not going to be able to answer that, and I could answer a lot of other things. So let's let Lawrence go with that one.
Green's version, and if you listen to his interviews and so forth, he probably has talked about it. He enjoyed arguing with people in the group theater. They didn't really come to blows. A number of those people, this is the early 1930s, were members of the Communist Party. Green was opposed to the Communist Party and its views of things. He considered himself a Jeffersonian Democrat. So, you know, they had a lot of back and forth on that in that kind of way. But he certainly respected their artistry, because he worked with them again a few years later on another play, Johnny Johnson, and enjoyed their energy. He was glad to work with them to get this play done. But it, you know, they had different views of things and talked them out and remained friendly. I ran into Harold Klurman, who was one of the leaders of the group theater years later, and he had very fond memories of Paul Green and wanted me to give Green his greetings and all that. And he said, you know, Green is just a big preacher.
Well, what kind of a preacher, Marcia? In the end, was he ultimately hopeful? I mean, how would you describe him, particularly at the end of his life?
I think he was always hopeful, and I think he always believed that change could come about. There's so many ways that I could describe this. Paul Green's work in his life with the arts and his human rights never really quite separated. They were always working together, and he wanted change. He wanted things to improve. There's the story of the chain gang, which was still going on in the early days, and Paul had heard from someone that down in Charlotte, two of the guards had tied up two of their chain gang people outside while they went in to have coffee, and it was bitter cold, and the men's fingers and toes froze. And he was so outraged by this. He was always walking over to Raleigh or going over to Raleigh and pounding his fist to try to get things done. And as a result of that situation, he wrote a little play called Hymn to the Rising Sun, that when he sent that little play to the legislators in Raleigh, was actually the beginning of the end of the chain gang. It showed how horrible it was. But he was hopeful. He wanted to lead the way. He was also known as the Lone Vigil, standing on the nights of execution at 2 o'clock in the morning when nobody is awake. He was going to be awake, and he was going to stand out there and be witness to the atrocities that were going on in the big house. And now hundreds and hundreds of people stand outside on nights of execution. So that is one of the missions of the foundation, is to carry on the work that Paul Green did during his life for arts and human rights. And one of our missions is to abolish the death penalty in North Carolina.
Well, as you say, he was busy in the arts and in human rights. He went for a while to Hollywood and wrote screenplays. Again, was he looking now to influence a larger audience? What was he hoping to do there, Lawrence?
He was. His first play was called Cabin in the Cotton, written in 1932 and starring Betty Davis. But it was a play championing the cause of tenant farmers against the big landowners, and a situation that he knew firsthand since tenant farmers had served and lived on his father's farm when he was growing up. This Rassie that Marcia talked about a while ago was the son of one of those tenant farmers. So he did. He wanted to make money. He wanted to extend his voice. And the opening screen of Cabin in the Cotton lists the author as Professor Paul Green, the University of North Carolina. He got much more prominent coverage for the work he did in Hollywood than writers do today, certainly. I don't know how typical it was in 1932, but yeah, he was quite hopeful when he went to Hollywood. And for the first several of his motion pictures, he was able to work out a social cause in the way that the first one championed the cause of tenant farmers. By the time the Second World War came, by the early 40s, he had pretty well given up on things had changed in Hollywood so much that the writer was just part of a committee putting a script together. Mm-hmm. And during the war, there wasn't much going on in the live theater. So to live, he wrote lots of movies during the 40s that didn't have much of a social message. But initially, during the 30s, the motion pictures he wrote really did.
Then he developed this idea called the symphonic drama, of which The Lost Colony is the most famous example. Tell us how that idea came along.
People in North Carolina, and especially on the East Coast, felt slighted because most of American history up into the early 20th century had been written by New England historians, mm-hmm. and they wanted to figure out a way to get North Carolina onto the historical map. And it dawned on them in the early 1930s, that 1937 would be the 350th anniversary of the first English attempt to set a colony in the New World. And they said, well, let's celebrate this 350th anniversary. Let's have a beauty pageant. Let's do a skit. Let's do this, that, and the other. And by then, Paul Green was already well known. He had won the Pulitzer Prize that you mentioned, and he'd written two or three motion pictures that attracted lots of attention. So the people on the East Coast, our East Coast, North Carolina's East Coast, got in touch with him, and they got the idea developed, all right, I'll write a historical—they kept calling it a pageant. Green very quickly realized he wasn't going to write a pageant, which was governed by the historical dictates, that he was going to write a play where the plot governed the action. But he made it a play, and initially they thought it was just going to run in 1937, and everybody was a little surprised because you couldn't get to Manteo. That's where they did the play, and there was no bridge. You had to take a ferry. There were no good roads. But they were amazed that 50, 60,000 people made their way out there that first summer. And so they said, well, let's do it next summer and the next and the next.
And they'll be doing it in 2012. We'll talk more about that play and the legacy of Paul Green with my guest Lawrence Avery at UNC Chapel Hill and Marcia Warren, executive director of the Paul Green Foundation. And we're going to also talk with Serena Ebhart and Stephen Roten when our program continues, and leave you with a little bit of the music from Lost Colony, and then we'll be back. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. We're talking about Paul Green today, the playwright, author, and activist, one of North Carolina's literary lights. My guests are Lawrence Avery, UNC Chapel Hill Professor Emeritus of English. Marcia Warren is Executive Director of the Paul Green Foundation. And actor and playwright Serena Ebhart is with us of Chatham County-based EBZB Productions. And also actor Stephen Roten, all here to talk about the legacy of Paul Green. Lawrence Avery, before the break, we were talking about The Lost Colony. And it was meant to be a one-and-done kind of production, 1937. It's been running ever since. First of all, summarize the story for those of us who don't really know it. What's the story of The Lost Colony? And then we'll find out how it's lasted so long.
Well, it opens in England when Sir Walter Raleigh is trying to get up backing for the colony and colonists to go on the trip. And he's decided to send families, not just troops of soldiers, but families, women, children, husbands. And then the group does get to the New World, and they get settled on Roanoke Island. And then very quickly after the birth of his own granddaughter, the governor of the colony, John White, has to go back to England for supplies, with the idea that he'll return in 6-8 weeks with food and other equipment that they need. But when he gets to England, England is just about to be attacked by the Spanish Armada, and Queen Elizabeth won't let any ships leave. So White is hung up in England, and the colonists have to make do with what they have and what they can get, what they can salvage. And conflicts with the Indians develop. They get word that Spanish invaders up from Florida are headed their way. And so the play ends with them marching off into history. And since they didn't leave any record, they're known as the Lost Colony.
They are the Lost Colony forever. Marcia Warren, as we say, this play was not the pageant that the organizers had hoped for or thought they were going to get. Was Paul Green surprised at its success?
Oh, I think he must have been. But he was very prepared because he really developed this genre. It's actually a kind of a separate genre called the symphonic outdoor drama. When he had served in France in the trenches in the First War, he had been in France, and he'd gone back. And he'd gone back to Germany and to France on Guggenheims, and later he went with UNESCO. And he was fascinated with theater that was going on, and he was fascinated with sound and light that the French were doing. And, of course, in Greece, the outdoor dramas that were taking place, that really inspired him. So when he came back, he developed this. And I think also, and Lawrence can correct me, but he really wanted theater to be for the people. And if you just did your plays on Broadway, how many common people get to go to Broadway and see plays? So this was meant for somebody who worked all day in blue jeans and milked the cows and all over the country. And Paul Green ended up writing 17 outdoor dramas. And it's quite a movement. There are outdoor dramas all across the country. So I think he'd be very pleased with how that has continued. Things have changed, though, because we don't have 17 outdoor dramas up right now. We only have about four, one in Ohio and one in Kentucky and one in Texas and one here in North Carolina.
Stephen Roden, I know you actually had a part in The Lost Colony, right?
I did.
There's probably not an actor in North Carolina who hasn't had a part.
Very few.
Serena, no, really? You haven't?
I've never been in The Lost Colony.
You know, both Andy Griffith and our friend Carl Castle. Carl Castle was in The Lost Colony and Andy Griffith. So, you know, you got to catch up.
I got to catch up.
Yeah,
my
yeah.
My resume is bereft.
Goldie Hawn, I think.
Just naming some of the people I know. go ahead. But, Stephen, you were in there. So what was that like? What kind of a play is that for an actor, and how does it compare to other things you've done?
Well, it was my first professional job as an actor, and it very much cemented the idea that I would go on to continue doing this for my life. I played about five different parts. I was a humble actor technician, which meant that I got to do it all. And I say got to because now I can look back and be thankful for that experience. Mm-hmm. But we were up at 8:30 in the morning sifting sand for the dancers' hairpins that would fall out and might damage our feet. Ooh. As we were playing Native Americans. I also got to play one of the wool-wearing soldiers when we were in the England settings. So it was, I got a wide variety of experience there. And I think one of the things that makes it so enduring, the question you asked earlier, was the spectacle and the draw. You know, there's a ship. The theater itself is just a beautiful spot there on the Sound. It really is a gorgeous experience, and they've had the wherewithal to keep very talented people connected with it. William Ivy Long, a whole new cadre of new costumes after the tragic fire there a couple of years ago. So just a great experience overall.
I guess it speaks to the breadth of his talent, too, Lawrence Avery, the idea that much of his art, much of his writing centered on a social mission, a kind of cause. This may be less so, but he certainly understood the elements of theater and what makes great theater.
Well, he did that, but there was a social cause behind The Lost Colony also. It came out, it may have slipped up even on Green, but they started off to celebrate the English heritage, but actually The Lost Colony turns out to be condemnatory of British society because it's so structured, it's such a hierarchy, the Queen down to Old Tom with everybody in between, and you can't break it. It's very rigid social order. And the point of the play is that the experience of the New World made a democratic society. In the New World, you weren't worth something because your daddy was a lord. You were worth something because you could work, you could contribute to the community. And I'm glad Stephen didn't say Ananias Dare was one of the people he played, because Ananias Dare in the play is the epitome of English rigidity, and he's made fun of. He's not really satirized, but he's made fun of several times and eventually gets killed.
But, you know, that underscores something that you said earlier about Paul Green's politics and maybe where he had disagreements with the group theater. He has said that what he didn't like about their politics was their sense of cynicism about the American, about American politics. He believed in democracy. He believed in the system, and he thought that it needed a whole lot of reform, but it was a good one to start with. Yeah. And that's reflected, I guess, in what you just said.
And one of the characters that Lawrence just was mentioning, Old Tom, we see him first in the streets outside of a pub in England, a very, very poor, down-and-out guy. And when he comes to the New World, he has a little speech up on the when he's keeping the watch that night, and he's walking along with his little gun, and he says, just imagine. Lawrence, do you have that place?
I happen to just have it right here.
Yeah, good. Just imagine my being here. I was nobody, and now I'm something. Yeah.
In England, he is on the bottom rung and has no hope of rising, but this is right at the end of the play, and he sort of announces that theme. He's standing watch over the colony to give the others a chance to rest, and he's walking back and forth. And I will be John Borden has just said, well, we'll remember all of your good work here. And Tom says, I will be remembered. I hope not. because there in England, everybody remembered me, and they remembered me with kicks and curses and terrible uses of tongues. And deep down, I drowned my sorrows in the mug. He was a drunken wastrel in the early scenes. But here, where there is no remembrance, I, who was lately nothing, am become somebody. For item, have I not now the keeping of some 60 souls in my care? I, who could never care for my own. Verily, Tom, I can hardly know thee in thy greatness. Roanoke, thou hast made a man of me. So this is the celebration of the experience. Somebody has achieved a sense of self-worth because of the open democratic society that had developed.
Something
I should have let Stephen read this.
Well, it's something that he reflects, too, in his own words. Paul Green, again, in this 1975 interview, explaining his approach to social activism and talking about watching then-President Ford on television during the Vietnam War.
Two philosophies. My philosophy was save the guy. Just like it's a hellish thing to me to send boys out to die for a cause. Well, I said, save that boy. Mm-hmm. And to hell with the cause. Mm-hmm. Like Mr. Ford out last week up there way at Arlington. He gets up and he hears all these white crosses of boys that have died.
There he is, Paul Green. So a real hope in the individual, particularly in a society like this.
I'd also like to say something else about the Lost Colony that has stuck with me, and I think it goes back to that little boy, Rassie, that little three-year-old boy who was his best friend. Paul is now a celebrated author. He's won the Pulitzer Prize. He's standing on the stage of the Lost Colony one night, and he's supposed to be making a speech. And he goes out to the center of the stage before the play begins, and he doesn't say anything, and he doesn't say anything. And the people on the wings are thinking, he's forgot his talk. He doesn't know what he's going to say. And finally he speaks and says, I look out tonight before you, and I see that rope in the middle of the theater. And I see that on one side are the Negroes, and I see on the other side are the white people. And I hope I live so long that that rope will be gone, and we'll all be sitting together.
And that was what year?
Do you know, Lawrence?
No, I don't. But it was in the late 50s, early 60s.
Right.
Well, and he did. But Serena Ephart, we're talking now about Paul Green's legacy, and you are someone who carries that forth in what you do. You bring plays and actually generate plays in places around the state. Tell us how Paul Green's work and life have affected your work.
In many ways, just from a technical standpoint, he was a playwright that used music. He was straight theater, but there was a lot of music in it. There was a lot of environmentalism in it. There was naturalism in it. There were, if you look at a play like The House of Connolly, these words are words you hear every day. They're the common man's words. It's not a lot of lofty. I mean, it's lofty in its symbolism, but they are real words. And so my technique of putting a play together is very heavily influenced by his, using all of the dramatic elements, even though it's not a big pageant necessarily. Also, I think our work at EBZB Productions is about telling stories that we think need to be heard. We're not so much about commercial success as we are about trying to find the common man's stories and pulling the inspiration out of those stories, watching how people move forward and celebrating the human spirit regardless of what they are faced with, that somehow the human spirit manages to reinvent itself and always move forward regardless of the tragedy imposed upon it. And as a playwright, I myself struggle with finding the hope sometimes. We look around, we watch the news. I find tuning into the news is devastating these days. So anything from the tsunami to a local robbery or shooting hits me like a ton of bricks. And I see that and I think, gosh, is there any hope for us? And that's when I feel like I've got to even fight harder for the hope, hope against hope sometimes. But we've got to put those messages out there because otherwise we're doomed.
Well, and it comes from you work with people in communities to develop their own plays, too.
Yes.
So they're telling their own stories and then reflecting their own lives in those places. And Marcia, the foundation plays an important. Tell us about the Paul Green Foundation and its role in supporting his legacy.
Well, we're very grateful to the four Paul Green children and to Paul Green's widow at the time. In 1981, Paul Green died, and the next year, the children and their mother decided to form a foundation and give up their rights to all of his literary work and his royalties, which was very, very gracious of them. And so in 1982, the foundation was formed. I've been involved with the foundation since 1991, so 20-some years. And we weren't making a lot of grants to begin with, and then we started learning how to make grants. And the beauty of this little foundation, and it is a very small foundation, we have very little money, but we make these grants, $1,000, $1,500, $2,000, to these little companies, these little nonprofit organizations that are doing the work that Serena is talking about. For example, this past year we supported the Pauli Murray Project that tells the story of this remarkable woman who's from North Carolina. We supported a project called Uniting North Carolina, and it's an immigrant story. And so we have been able to, with our little bit of funds, we have since 2007 actually become a donor-advised fund of the Triangle Community Foundation. So that is going to assure us that we will be able to make these grants in perpetuity.
And you recently found a film based on one of Paul Green's.
Well, we're excited about this. We have a lovely woman named Margaret Bauer, Dr. Bauer, who is a professor of English at ECU. And she's been becoming a kind of a Paul Green scholar, hasn't she, Lawrence?
She sure
has. She's doing some really good work. And she wanted to teach her students about the House of Connolly. So she is planning to do this. And so she said, I know there's a film out there, but I can't find it. And it turns out that in 1934, a film was made in Hollywood called Carolina. And after much looking, and I was checking and Googling everything, she finally found it at Eastman up in Rochester. And we have, for a rather great price, decided to borrow this at a great price. And we have this film until August the 20th. And so we're going to be hopeful that we'll be able to have screening of Carolina.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Marcia Warren, Executive Director of the Paul Green Foundation. Lawrence Avery is a UNC Chapel Hill Professor Emeritus of English. Serena Ebhart is the co-founder and co-owner of EBZB Productions, a playwright and an actor, and actor Stephen Roten. Thank all of you for being on the program today.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The State of Things. You can find us at our website, stateofthings.org. Check us out on Facebook as well. The State of Things is produced by Amber Nimix and Alex Granados. Bill Kumpf and Nasser Abbas are our interns. Robin Copley, the technical director, managing editor Lindsay Foster Thomas, and Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.